Well, we're looking through the Sermon on the Mount, and we may finish it tonight. And we've seen the Beatitudes and the introductory statements about what it means to be a disciple. And then last week, we moved into a saying of Jesus, unless your righteousness, your determination to do God's will, is deeper than that of the scribes and Pharisees, you can't enter the kingdom. Then Matthew gathers together the Decalogue, the Ten Commandments, effectively, those ones which relate to our relationship with each other. And we concluded looking at the fifth commandment, thou shalt not kill, and we saw the difference where Jesus goes right into the heart. It's the attitude we have to each other that matters. The heart that kills, the thoughts that kill, the way we relate to each other. And tonight we begin with the sixth commandment, which you all know very well, thou shalt not commit adultery. So that's where we begin. So Matthew, picking up Jesus' ideas and perhaps words as well, says, you've heard that it was said you shall not commit adultery, but I say to you. Now before we look at what Jesus says, we better look at what adultery is for the readers of the gospel. And it isn't the same as for you. So prepare for a slight change of emphasis. In a world which I've already described for you in chapter 1 of the genealogy, in a world which assumed that the man produced life, the seed of life, and the woman was the garden which nurtured it, in a world which didn't understand the biology of male and female intercourse or communion in bringing about life, then adultery itself has a quite specific meaning. A man, therefore, who has life in his seed, so they understood or misunderstood, then the man would marry and he would have possession. This would be the garden, his garden, his wife. And he had rights to his wife. Not only that, he had a right that the children whom she conceived were his. So adultery in Jewish law, and here in our New Testament world as well, is if a woman who is married, note that, has intercourse with any man at all, then the man and woman are both responsible for adultery. Why? Because the man and the woman are acting in ways that go against the rights of her husband. Clear? So, if a married man has sexual relationships with a divorced woman, with an unmarried woman, there's no adultery. Be clear about that. I'm not saying it's a good thing to do, but it's not adultery according to Jewish law. Because no one possesses that woman. They're not behaving in a way that's against anybody's rights. It's still a sexual sin and moral sin, but it isn't adultery. Now, you wouldn't particularly like that if you're a woman, I wouldn't imagine. But please remember, that's the world we're talking about. And that was based on their biology, I presume, and the patriarchy and so on. But accept that as fact, because that is the fact. Then, okay, it was said to you of old, you shall not commit adultery. Meaning, if a woman is possessed by, married to, committed to a man, then no other man has a right to sexual relationships with her, and she must be faithful to her husband's rights. Now, what does Jesus say? And in the first, there are two things he says. We're going to look one of them now and one of them next. But the first thing he says, he doesn't change the definition of adultery in this passage. It may be assumed, but it's not that he says, but I say this to you, everyone who looks at a woman with lust has committed adultery with her in his heart. Now, he doesn't say whether the woman's married or unmarried. We can't assume anything from just that passage. So let's leave it within the categories we're looking at. But what he's doing here is internalizing it. He's now no longer talking about an external action. He's talking about an attitude of heart, a way of looking at each other, and still from the male point of view. Everyone who looks at a woman with lust has already committed adultery with her in his heart. So once again, the morality of Christianity is about how's your heart. It includes external actions, of course, but it's much, he goes to the heart of our actions. And then, say this quickly, if your right eye causes you to sin, he's just talked about looking with lust. So here we have an exaggerated, dramatic way of making the point. If your right eye causes you to sin, tear it out, throw it away. It's better for you to lose one of your members than with your whole body to be thrown into hell. Not thrown into hell by God. Hell is the perdition, it's the waste, it's the result of self-destructive behaviour. So why destroy your soul just for the glance and the look and the passion of that? No, look after your soul, says Jesus. And if your right hand causes you to sin, cut it off, throw it away. Of course, it's not meant to be taken literally, you know that. But it's better for you to lose one of your members than have your whole body go to hell. So care about what matters, which is your heart and your body, of course, your whole person. But look after your heart, is what Jesus says. And don't let your heart commit adultery. However, he goes further. And now he actually changes the definition of adultery. It was also said, he says, whoever divorces his wife, let him give her a certificate of divorce. We'll do this much more thoroughly when Matthew does it more thoroughly in chapter 19. So I'll do it very quickly now and promise you that Matthew himself will do it more at full later. But basically, the system used to be in the male world that a man could just do what he liked with his wife, really. And anyhow, it was a polygamous world, many wives. And maybe that was appropriate in that tribal situation. We're not here to judge that. But that was the situation. And then later it develops into monogamy, but with very easy rights of a man to dismiss a wife. Financial problems were the only ones that would hinder him, and love, hopefully. But a law came in Deuteronomy which put controls on that. And you can read it yourself in Deuteronomy chapter 24. And it just says, well, if a man does divorce his wife, and it doesn't say whether he should or shouldn't, but if he does, then she's free. That's the point of that Deuteronomic law. He can't then do what he likes and then call her back as though she's still his. He has to give her a writ which leaves her free then to go and marry someone else and have a family and build a world if she possibly can. She may not be able to, but she was given certain rights by the Deuteronomic law, which was a step in the right direction, a tiny step. But Jesus says, I say to you, anyone who divorces his wife, and then comes a strange little sub-clause here, except on the grounds of unchastity, and we'll have to look at that word, but anyone who divorces his wife, with this rider here, causes her to commit adultery. Now that's all new. You've understood my definition before? Because once a woman was divorced, then if another man has sexual relationships with her, well, he's got no rights anymore because he's divorced her. So there's no question of adultery. Jesus says there is. He's forcing her into committing adultery. So he's actually looking, as we'll see in Matthew 19, he's looking at marital relationships not as the rights of a man over a woman, which are foregone or foreclosed by divorce, but as a covenant commitment in love, which is actually a sacrament of what God's love is like. So it's a whole new, beautiful, well, you know, that way of looking at what's going on here. And he goes on, and whoever marries a divorced woman commits adultery. Now, that would have shocked all his audience, the men, because he's putting a real accent on this relationship, which is at the heart of love, trust, family, and so on. But, and that's all he says in this part, and that's all I'll say one more thing and then leave it, because it's developed much later, better later. But Matthew, and Matthew alone, has this clause, except on the ground of unchastity. The Greek, if you want, is porneia. Porneia, porne in Greek means a prostitute. So porneia is a very general word for sexually irresponsible behaviour such as prostitutes go on with. That kind of general word. What it means in this context has been debated for quite a while. Some even Christian groups have taken that to mean adultery. So if your wife commits adultery, then you may divorce her. That isn't the meaning of it. It can't be established. There's a different word for adultery. I think now scholars have come to a consensus, which I'm about to give you in case you don't know it, of what the meaning of this exceptional clause is. There may be some dispute still going on, but to my knowledge, the whole weight of scholarship has come into a certain place. And I'll now solve that for you or share it with you. That same word, porneia, unchastity, whatever that means in this general context, is found also in the Acts of the Apostles, in the text that I've shared with you there, chapter 15, verse 28 to 29. Now that's the conclusion of the Council of Jerusalem. The Council of Jerusalem was called because of the problem of Gentiles becoming Christians without following the law. Paul was doing this. And so the James and Cephas, or Peter in Jerusalem, they called the whole church together to discuss this. Because many thought, no, that's wrong, they should be Jews and they should follow the law. Others said no. And well, the people who said no won out in that council. And the decision was made, Peter having spoken by the, let's call him the bishop, to use a word a bit out of context, but the leader, the overseer of the church in Jerusalem, a man called James, the brother of the Lord, so some family relationship with Jesus himself. And they decided, and this was their decision, Acts 15:28, it has seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us, having discerned in prayer, in other words, to impose on you, Gentiles, and this letter is sent to Antioch, probably the place where Matthew's Gospel comes from. Hence, it's in Matthew's Gospel, I suggest. It has seemed good to the Holy Spirit and to us to impose on you no further burden than these essentials. These are the only things we'll ask you to do. Abstain from what's been sacrificed to idols, and from blood, and from what is strangled, and from unchastity, the same word. Now, if you look at those four things that they're asked to fit in with the law about, none of the other three are moral issues at all in themselves. They're cultural questions. Jews didn't eat meat sacrificed to idols. The Gentiles said, oh, well, idols are only idols, don't worry about it. We know they're only statues, forget about it. It's cheap meat, let's get it and eat it. Paul argues like that himself in his letter to the Romans and to the Corinthians. There's nothing wrong with the meat just because sacrificed to idols. There aren't such things as idols, and yeah, forget it, eat it if you want to. But that's very hard for the Jews to do because they've been instructed for years not to do it. So this instruction, very wisely, I think, pastorally, the church in Jerusalem says to the Gentiles in Antioch, look, you don't have to follow the law, but please don't do this, because it's obviously terribly upsetting to the Jews and they can't handle it in their body, you know, it's like a psychological problem. And don't drink blood either, because it's so, I mean, you're sitting at a table drinking blood and I'm sitting there and I'm a Jew and I'm, you know, it's all pretty uncomfortable stuff. So, you know, don't do it out of love for the community so that you're not hurting people's sensitivity, that's all. And don't eat meat like a rabbit, that if you haven't got out of them, anyhow. Meat that's strangled because the blood's still in it. And the Jews see that as life and they see it as sacred and they see you doing something that's kind of taboo. So please don't do that. And unchastity emerges suddenly in this list, and some people might think that means fornication or something. It can mean that, but it doesn't here. It means married relationships that are out of sync with the Jewish Torah. And if you look up Leviticus chapter 18, there are certain first cousins and father-in-law and daughter-in-law, you know, certain, every culture has them, limits to the people you can marry, mainly incest, to keep the genes good, I suppose, whatever the reasons. So, and to protect family and all that kind of thing. Well, the Gentiles didn't have the same customs. So they may well have had married relationships that didn't fit in with this. So the church in Jerusalem seems to be talking not about morality here, but about custom and social mores and ease in community. And the suggestion that scholars make is that the unchastity in Acts 15:29 is the same here. And that that exception clause in Matthew is really saying anyone who divorces his wife, except in cases where the union itself that you're talking about is not according to the laws of Leviticus, it's not a regular marriage. It's a living together arrangement, and it might have social and legal implications outside the Christian community, but it's not a marriage that the community recognises. If it's not a marriage the community recognises, well, it's not really a marriage, and so, of course, you can divorce and marry. That's the point of that exception clause. What it does, however, and I won't speak of it anymore now, it introduces, very, very importantly, a rider to stop us making the mistake of thinking that Jesus is suddenly making an absolute rule about marriage, as though marriage was somehow beyond human relationships and beyond discernment, and as though every young man or young woman or any age person marry. Well, if they marry in the courts, they're married. No, they may not be. So what appears to be a marriage may not really be a marriage according to the social expectations of people or so on. So already we're being introduced to a need not to absolutize this rule about divorce and remarriage. Do you follow my logic? There's already a rider in there that there can be marriages that are not really marriages that Jesus is talking about. Paul will also make much more profound discernments in his letter to the Corinthians, and the church and the Christian community has always had to keep doing this and still will need to do it, because some marriages can be, as you know, destructive and so on and need to be broken for the sake of life and many other things. But the principle is still here. Marriage, as all of you who have married would want it to be anyhow, is a communion and a covenant, and it's sacred. And men who run the law don't think they can run all this and do what they like about it. So Jesus has both taken us to the heart of the way man and woman look at each other and feel towards each other and reach out to each other. And he's also protected an intimate relationship against the legal, patriarchal ease with which it could be readily broken to the disadvantage of everybody. And now we move to the eighth commandment. Again, you've heard it said in ancient times, you shall not swear falsely. Swear does not mean say bloody or the other equivalent. Swear means take an oath on God, you know? So it's an oath. You shall not swear falsely, but you shall carry out the vows you have made to the Lord. That's the New Revised Standard Version translation. I think it's a wrong translation, however brilliant they might be. The word used is not the word for vow, it's the word for oath, and they're not the same. Can't understand that. A vow is a solemn promise made to God. That's not what this text is about. It's about calling on God to witness the truth of what you say, and that's an oath. Perhaps a vow taken under oath. So, but Jesus says to you, look, in other words, the law is saying if you're going to call on God to support your truth, make sure you're speaking the truth. That's fair enough, isn't it? That's what the law says. But Jesus goes further and he says, I say to you, don't swear at all. either by heaven, for it's the throne of God, or the earth, it's its footstool, or Jerusalem, the city of the great king, and don't swear by your head, you can't make a hair black or white. Let your word be yes, yes, or no, no, says Jesus. Anything more comes from the evil one. Right from the beginning of Christianity, however, the church has accepted the community's need to make people take oaths sometimes to protect the community against untruth. We still do it in the courts. So it's never been understood absolutely either, this. And we've got to be careful about absolutizing the beautiful values that Jesus puts before us. I think what he's saying is, they say to you, make sure you speak the truth when you've called God to witness to you. I say this to you, make sure you speak the truth, because another person deserves it. It's about communication. It's not about when God supports you, you can speak the truth, but if not, well, you can do what you like. No, no, always speak the truth in love. Always do the truth in love. And even that, you know, has to be qualified, because some people have no right to the truth. And you can be blatant in lying to them. A priest doesn't have to do this often, but I tell you, I would. I mean, if someone came to me and said, did someone go to you to confession today? You know what I mean? I could say no, and I'd say it straight. Look them in the eye. And I'm really saying you've got no... Because if you say, well, do you know? They can presume they did. Of police... Well, you know what I mean? We're protecting the seal of confession. And we're all protecting certain things, and some people, if they have no right to the truth, you can, and anything but a blunt statement makes them know that what they've got no right to know, be blunt and tell them a lie straight down the middle. Because what you're saying is, back off, mind your own business. I hope you accept that. Yeah, that's my advice for you, of what it's worth. Because some people tell the truth when they shouldn't. When they hurt themselves and they hurt others and so on. And you don't have to, you have to tell the truth but not always speak it. And if someone has no rights, they've got no rights. But in general, that's what Jesus is saying here. James quotes him in chapter 5, verse 12. James, the writer of Jerusalem, listen to this, it's almost straight out of here. My beloved, don't take oaths either by heaven or by earth or by any other oath. Let your yes be yes and your no be no. James 5:12. So there Jesus is going to the heart of communication and to the heart of truth. And now we go beyond the Ten Commandments and we come back almost to that beatitude of Jesus about being meek. Blessed are the meek, Matthew 5:5, which we looked at some length last time. And the meek, if you remember, are those who are strong and gentle, both together. Gentle but strong. You've heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Sounds jungle warfare, doesn't it? But it's not that at all. That's the lex talionis, they call it from the Latin, who knows, Exodus chapter 21. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth was a restriction on revenge, and a wise one. In a tribal situation where I'd take out your eye and you'd kill me, or I'd steal a sheep and you'd take all my farm because you had the power to do it. And this rule says no. It's about justice. If I take your sheep, you can take my sheep, but no more, even if you're the king. An eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. Not literal, but you know what I mean? In the court, you could only get restitution for what was robbed, not beggar everybody just because of your power. Well, it's a good law, but it's not good enough for Jesus. You've heard it said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. You hurt me, I hurt you. You invade my country, I invade yours. You drop a bomb in our thing, I'll drop a bomb in yours. It's going on all over the Middle East. You ought to know what that's about. So that kind of behaviour. Jesus says, I say to you, don't resist the one who does evil to you. Don't resist them. If someone strikes you on the right cheek, turn the other also. That's a difficult phrase, but I suggest to you that its meaning is possibly really simple. I'll tell you when I first thought I understood this text. It was in Italy, actually. And I don't know why I was... Sometimes you're thinking about things and structure. And I just saw two people kissing each other. Nice to watch, isn't it? Now, but you know how they go like that on one... I don't know which is first. And then there's the other side. You get both. We're not used to that. And it was my first time in Italy, and they were giving each other both sides. So I was ducking for cover quick. So you're getting the both sides. And I think that's the image here. You go up to someone to greet them in love, and you turn, let's say, your right cheek. But instead of them accepting your greeting, they strike you. I don't mean literally, physically, necessarily, but they reject your love, or perhaps strike you in some way, hurt you. Jesus is saying, finish off the kiss. Give them your left cheek too. Now that's, again, like all these images, they're graphic, not to be followed to the letter, but isn't he saying, okay, if you hurt me, say I happen to be a gentle kind of person, and you behave really ugly towards me, that's bad enough. But how foolish I would be if I then became ugly back to you, because then you've two things have gone wrong. One, I've been hurt by you. Secondly, I've let you distort who I am and behave in ways that are not me. That's two bad things have happened. Was if you strike me in some way, Jesus is saying, stay who you are. Don't be a fool, don't be a doormat, don't be stupid and keep loving someone who keeps hitting you on the head. Well, that's crazy. You know, you've got to learn, and we all do. But can we stay? Can we keep who we are? Can we retain our dignity? Can we keep loving? Even if loving means walking away, it may well be. But don't turn into a revenge person. Don't do to others what they do to you that hurts. I think that's what he's saying. If anyone, and similar images, and I'll just rush through these. If someone wants to sue you and take your coat, well, give them your cloak. Well, that might be good advice. I don't know what the heck you'd do, but often it probably would be. Well, I'm not going to give you my coat, and then 10 years later when the courts have sorted it all out, you've lost 10 years of your life and maybe got your coat back, and by now it's worn out. I don't know. You've got to fight for your rights, I suppose, and all that, but at least let's look at it. And Jesus is basically saying, don't be but be generous, be yourself, and don't get things out of proportion. And just because someone's bad to you, you don't have to be bad back to them. If anyone forces you to go a mile, go a second mile. Give to anyone who begs from you. Don't refuse anyone who wants to borrow from you. I hate saying Paul is improving on Jesus, but I think he's improving on Matthew. Paul in Romans 12:21 has a magnificent little sentence. He's thought about all this, and here's his wisdom for you. Instead of saying, don't resist the evildoer, he says, overcome evil. Resist it, you could say, with good. That's I think, really got it all really beautifully. In other words, don't succumb to evil. Don't let it run your life. Don't just let it fall all over you. Overcome it. The gates of hell shall not prevail against the church, says Jesus. So if you look, get that image clear, the gates and the church is like a ramrod. Or what is that the right word for these big things? They barge into the gate of a city and try and knock it down in the ancient world? You know, belt. So who's on the attack? The world? No. The world's a fortress locked into a black hole. The church is on the attack with light and love and demand and words and vision. And he says the gates of hell won't even hold out against the church. So get in there with your mission and crash into it with love. Be proactive and overcome evil, yeah, but not with evil, with love, with good. Lastly, the beautiful conclusion to this chapter 5. You know, really, this is at the basis of the whole understanding of Jesus and discipleship and the Sermon on the Mount. And it's our image of God. Your image of God will determine your behaviour and mine. That's why it's just so important that we purify our image of God and be very careful what we hand on to our children. Don't use God as a backstop for your or my disciplinary behaviour or lack of patience, or don't call God in with a big stick because he hasn't got one. You've heard it was said, love your neighbour, meaning your Jewish brother and sister, and hate your enemy. Well, nowhere in the Bible does it say strictly hate your enemy, but there's plenty of texts that have pretty well got that. So love your neighbour and hate your enemy. I tell you, says Jesus, what an extraordinary thing, love your enemies. Well, there it is. If ever you find yourself doing that, come and tell me what you're doing and how you do it. And I'll arrange for your canonization, because I've got friends in high places. Loving enemies must be the hardest thing to do. And Jesus did it beautifully. And aren't we glad? And we could do it too, because we're meant to love, nothing else. You can do it. Love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you, hound you. And why does he say to do that? That you may be sons of your Father in heaven. Sons, the word mightn't sit too well if you're a woman, but don't lose the idea of it. It doesn't mean children of God only. It doesn't mean a daughter or a son of God. In other words, gender specific. It means sons in the sense of united to the Son, Jesus. I live no longer I, but Christ lives in me. So to be a son of God isn't just to be a child of God. Do you follow me? It's to be united with Jesus. It has that meaning in it, and it shouldn't lose it just for the sake of inclusive language. Love your enemies, pray for them, and then, says Matthew, you can be like Jesus, the Son of God. You can love the way he loved. And look at what the Father does, according to Jesus. He causes his Son to rise on evil and good. So if you're ever going to say to your children, grandchildren or great-grandchildren, and I'm getting close to having great-grandnieces and nephews, so some of you might be up to great-grandchildren soon, if you say to them, if you are naughty, God won't love you, you're a heretic. If you're naughty, God's going to be bursting with love for you to change you. Because he causes his Son to rise on the evil and the good. And he sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous. So be like God. Just love. Won't do anyone any harm. Might even change them. If you love those who love you, what reward will you get? Don't even the tax collectors do that? And if you greet only your brothers, what are you doing more than others? Don't even pagans do that? No, you be perfect as your Father is perfect. Be like God. And this perfection of the Beatitudes and the perfection that Jesus is inspiring us in the Sermon on the Mount, please don't think of it as an ideal. We're not talking about ideals like stars in the sky to be reached for. This is all about an inner dynamism of discipleship. This is the river of energy. This is what it means to have God's Spirit. This is what it means to have the heart of Jesus. If you have the heart of Jesus and the Spirit of Jesus, it will impel you to become poor in spirit, meek, peacemakers, gentle, all the rest of the Beatitudes and all of this. It's an inner energy that is yours to call on and mine. So it's very attainable stuff. Attainable in God's time and in your time and all that. So let's be perfect, he says, as your Father is perfect. Perfect in love. And everything we've said in chapter 5 is all about ways of loving. Just some texts that say that same thing elsewhere in the New Testament. You might like to jot the references down if you want, but if it's up to you if you like them or not. Ephesians chapter 5 says, verse 1, be imitators of God. Now, if you think God is a judge that's out to get you, I hope you don't. That makes me think you might be out to get me. Because if you're going to imitate God, you better be pretty tough. And if you think God doesn't, the way we think God is probably going to affect our behaviour enormously. Well, if God is love, be imitators of God as beloved children and live in love, says Paul. As Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice to God. God loved the way Jesus behaved when he kept loving. St. John, the beloved disciple, first letter, chapter 4. Beloved, let's love one another because love's from God. Everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. Whoever doesn't love doesn't know God, for God is love. God's love was revealed among us in this way. God sent his only Son into the world so that we might live through him. And you're only alive, aren't you, when you're in love. Love's the only thing that brings life to us human beings. So why do anything else? In this is love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us. And he sent his Son to be the atoning sacrifice for our sins. We're poor, broken people. We're not sure how to love. We haven't been loved all that well, probably, most of us, most of the time, because we've been loved by pretty imperfect human beings who weren't loved all that well, and that's original sin that goes back to Adam and Eve. So we've all got great limitations on our capacity to love, and we're very sensitive of that, and we probably don't think we do it very well often, and all of that, and that's true. But God is love, and God's love can come through us and in us, and he can teach us how to love. In spite of our hurts and our imperfections and our failures and so on. In spite of our sins. Beloved, since God loved us so much, we should love one another. No one's ever seen God. But if we love one another, God lives in us and his love is perfected in us. That's Paul and John and now Peter, that beautiful man who made all the mistakes in the world and kept bouncing back. Be like obedient children, says Peter. As he who called you is holy, you be holy too in your conduct. Love one another deeply from the heart.